Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council condemns the president's comments but can't find a way out of hosting next summer's GOP convention. Meanwhile, council approves more affordable housing units, and some members put pressure on American Airlines to raise wages. CMPD Chief Kirk Putney meets with the Citizen Review Board about policy changes surrounding the deadly use of force, or the use of deadly force. CMS gets a new temporary leader, a major bank merger gets some opposition, and North Carolina lawmakers react to Robert Mueller's congressional testimony. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Sarah D'Elia from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno's here. He's a reporter with WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Hello, hello.
Hey, Mike.
And Jonathan Lowe is a reporter and anchor for Spectrum News. Welcome back.
Good morning,
and
Mike.
Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
We're all on the radio. We're also on Facebook Live this morning. Well, the reverberations from the Donald Trump comments about four congresswomen known as the Squad made their way into Monday's Charlotte City Council meeting. Trump said that the four Democrats, all women of color, should go back to the countries from which they came. And the council approved a resolution that condemned the president for what they called racist and xenophobic language. All nine Democrats voted in favor. Councilman Justin Harlow spearheaded that resolution.
This resolution seeks to not talk so much about a convention or political parties, but simply about what should be not debatable, simply what should be a non-starter all the time. Racism, xenophobia, bigotry, hate speech.
How unusual is it for this council, for any council for that matter, to take a vote on or to pass a resolution like this condemning a national figure?
I think it is unusual. If you remember back in 2017 after the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Dimpalesh Mira wanted to pass a resolution condemning basically what happened there. And she had no takers on council. She couldn't even get a second for her motion because they didn't want to get too political. She asked the city then to craft something, and the city never released a statement condemning Charlottesville. So what council did on Monday really was unique and different.
Hmm. Do you want to jump in here, Jonathan?
No, go ahead.
Okay, all right. Councilwoman Dimpalesh Mira, who you just mentioned, a Democrat, and one of those who voted in favor of the resolution, said this is not a time to be neutral.
And I was approached by many folks and have been told to go back to the whole country that I came from. So when those words were said at the rally, it brought tears to my eyes. And unfortunately, this has become a norm.
So the resolution mentioned the Trump rally in Greensboro last week, in which the crowd picked up on Donald Trump's sentiments by chanting, send her back. It was a reference to Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who moved from the U.S., moved to the U.S. from Somalia as a child. Ajmera's reaction to this is understandable, but is this something city council constituents believe they should be concerning themselves with?
Well, if you look at all the people that came and spoke and tried to impress the council to pull out of the RNC, plainly, these were people of different backgrounds, male, female, black, white, who were basically asking the city council to rescind or pull out of that contract. So, there is a part of our community that, is on pins and needles about what could happen with RNC and if that rally the rally that happened in Greenville, if that could happen here.
Everybody wants to chime in on this. So, Glenn, you were first. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think even though Justin Harlow went to great lengths to try to separate this from the convention. Let's be honest, this was about the convention.
Mm-hmm.
This would not have been on council's docket were the convention not coming here next year. So going back to the question you asked initially, It's just unusual for a city government to pass a resolution condemning a national figure. It is very unusual, but it does happen when that city has a stake in whatever that national figure did or said. And Charlotte clearly has a stake in this.
Mm-hmm. Sarah.
Yeah, if you look at the timeline, Charlottesville was in 2017, and then we vote on the RNC coming to Charlotte in 2018. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, somebody died in Charlottesville. It was a violent protest that happened. So it is interesting that it's taken an incident happening in our state for council to be okay with reacting to it to some way. And I do think that it was probably the most sincere that we've seen Councilwoman Ajmera kind of just reflect on in a way that no one else on council really can because of her unique experience.
And just to be clear, this did have, for some on city council, something to do with RNC. We do know that several on city council reached out to the city attorney. That's why he addressed this on Monday.
Which we'll talk about.
Yeah. So, and I don't want to get ahead of you there, okay. But we know that this had something to do. And I was in contact with Justin, even though he wanted to make that resolution a little bit more broad and not focus specifically on the president and the rally that happened in Greenville, they did look into trying to back out. And I can add more in a bit. But okay.
I think people who oppose the RNC being in Charlotte viewed the action as council as being the least city leaders could do.
Yeah, this resolution doesn't just refer to the send her back chance or the president referring to the squad. It lists all these different things that they feel he has done that need a rebuke, including the fact that he said in 2017, 15,000 recent immigrants from Haiti all have AIDS, and that 40,000 Nigerians, once seeing the United States, would never go back to their huts in Africa. In 2017, they referred to what he called very nice people on both sides of the Charlottesville situation. In 2018, President Trump, they say, referred to undocumented immigrants as animals, and it goes on. I mean, it's a whole litany of things that they say the president, and in fact, the president did say these things. It's not, they didn't make this up.
It's on tape.
That's right, and that is why they're passing this resolution. The vote was 9-2, with all Democrats voting in favor, because everything today is partisan. The council's two Republicans voted no. One, Tariq Bokhari, echoed many other rank-and-file Republicans. He indicated he did not see racism in these tweets, though he said he opposed the send her back sentiment as tyrannical. I'm not sure why it would be tyrannical, but okay. And he accused the council of having selective outrage.
You know what's so bothersome to me about this is in this day and age, it feels like the word racism is thrown around a lot like the word witch was in the 1600s. Oh, you don't like that? Right. I bet not. But in the 1600s, you never knew what motivated the accuser of calling someone a witch, and the accused had a near impossible task in proving that they were not. That seems very similar to how we use the word racism today.
So the person interjecting Jesus Christ into the conversation was Braxton Winston, fellow councilman there. Does he have a point, or can we look at a statement and call it racist on the face of it?
He does not have a point. He was wrong. As a black man who has been a victim of racist verbal harassment, I recognize the trope, go back. I first heard that trope shortly after desegregation when I was in the fourth grade, when little kids told me to go back to Africa. I heard that trope later as a journalist when people did not like something I had written. And they'd send me an email or a letter, why don't you go back to Africa? It was unfortunate that this became a partisan issue. It didn't have to be. Anyone who represents this government or our local government should recognize that.
But if you look at some of the tape that national reporters have put on television, they've gone and talked to people who were at that rally in Greenville, North Carolina, people who were not, from the way they spoke and the way they looked, you wouldn't call them rednecks. They were intelligent. They seem to be thoughtful people, and they did not see racist intent in those comments. How can that be? How can we be so bifurcated that we can't see that?
I think we see what we want to see. And perhaps they've never been the victim of racial or ethnic harassment.
I doubt it.
But those of us who have been,
yeah,
we know it when we see it, and we know it when we hear it.
Tariq Bakari, who opposed the resolution, proposed to amend it by saying, quote, whereas we condemn some forms of racism and xenophobia where it fits our narrative, and in doing so we are prepared to make assumptions as to what is in the hearts of those saying it. And he goes on, but at that point, the mayor, I think, asked him if he was serious. And he said, as serious as the resolution the council proposed. Did he mention the forms of racism that we tend to ignore?
He did not, and because he made that motion, council actually had to vote on it. So that will be in minutes for historians to look at forever. And of course, that resolution, it failed.
So meanwhile, council's other Republican, Ed Driggs, told council that although he did not approve of Trump's utterances, he supports him because he said Trump's policies have been good for the country. It should be pointed out that he is facing a challenge in the Republican primary for re-election, and that may or may not have played a role in his thinking, because a lot of Republicans who might be speaking out aren't, because they don't want to be trumped. But he went on to ask why the council wasn't offended by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the members of Congress Trump has been directing his comments toward, and her calling border detention centers concentration camps, saying that the president didn't create the tension we are experiencing.
I don't think we have really good behavior on either side, and I'm not prepared to lay the blame for the situation that we're in that none of us likes entirely at the feet of one man. We should all look inside ourselves. Listen to the anger here tonight. Racist, bigot. We are here to express our hatred of a guy that we consider to be hateful. Look at yourselves.
Wow. Did anyone on council, or does the language contained in the resolution, which I've read and I don't think it does, but I'll ask the question anyway, express hatred for the president or merely condemnation of what he says?
Condemnation of what he says.
So how is it that we have somebody saying that we're hating the president through the language in this resolution?
Well, it sounds like that is the characterization from the other side of, if you have anything bad to say, or you don't like anything that the president is doing or any of his policies or something, that you hate him.
You know, there was a time
when wasn't that the case in the Obama administration? On the other side, when you flip the coin. I'm just asking the questions.
Glenn and I are smiling.
I'm glad I'm not sitting on your side of the desk. Go ahead, Glenn. I'm sorry.
There was a time when we thought it was prudent to hold our president to a higher standard.
That's not prudent anymore?
Apparently not.
Okay.
Apparently not.
Then we're doomed.
We can argue that there's bad in all of us, and that is true. But we're all not the leader of the free world.
Right.
We're all not president of the United States.
How do you explain the shift in sentiment toward how we treat the highest, most powerful person in the world? I don't care who's in the office. The office of president is the most powerful person in the world. Why don't we expect more from that person? Why don't
television.
We hold him to a higher television?
What's reality television.
Oh. Well, he's not on The Apprentice anymore. This is real.
Right.
I mean, seriously, his
but
comments,
isn't it,
the way
is,
he
de-
his decorum is beneath the dignity of the office, period. I shouldn't say that, but I'm saying it.
Can't we say that he proves that a reality TV show host can be come president and still continue that trend of being a reality TV personality?
Evidently. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks in the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Sarah D'Elia is here from WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV, where he's a reporter. And Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. So Ed Driggs has just talked. We just played a piece of tape from Ed at the council meeting at which he voted against this resolution that the council passed with regard to the president's comments in recent years, particularly with regard to his comments about the four congresswomen. And his point of view, Ed Drake's point of view, is kind of a microcosm of the entire country in terms of how we look at the same thing and see something different. Democrats see racist intent in Donald Trump's comments. Most Republicans do not. Driggs said that we don't have good behavior on either side, which sounds a little like Charlottesville, and is not prepared to lay the blame at the president's feet. Democrats would say that Trump brought this on himself by comments that date back to before his presidency. So what led us to this point where we can no longer evaluate a statement on the face of it and on the facts presented and come to the same conclusion? This is a problem for democracy.
One of the points Ed Driggs was trying to make on Monday was that city council just shouldn't be having this discussion at all, that they should be focusing on local issues, and bad things happen when they wade into national issues like this.
But as go ahead.
This is a local issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If for no other reason but the convention is heading here, and a lot of people are worried that it will be a violent, confrontational convention out in the streets. We hope that doesn't happen. But getting back to your question, how did we get here? This did not start with Donald Trump.
No.
This started a long time ago. This started, this started when politics started to become toxic. Politics have always been contentious, but I would say maybe a decade or so ago with Newt Gingrich. And if you read some of their biographies and their autobiographies, They are very upfront in acknowledging that they had a strategy to win by separating and using racist overtones. They're very upfront about that, and that has progressed over the years until we have Donald Trump.
And I think Driggs did have a point when he said that this tension wasn't just – Donald Trump didn't just create this tension. It was there before. And I think especially all of us that covered the 2016 election, we can attest to that, of just how much tension there was and how some people were very surprised that there was that amount of tension. But there it was. So like Glenn said, this didn't just happen under the Trump presidency. It's been there for a while.
I think the Willie Horton ad was probably the first overtly – use of race to win votes in modern history, and it just progressed from there under Lee Atwater, when Lee Atwater was over the Republican Party, and each election has become increasingly toxic.
Yes, Lee Atwater told me once in a makeup room before an interview that in politics the ends always justify the means. The president's comments, followed by the rally in Greenville, have caused, somebody brought up, I think it was you, Jonathan, Charlotte, to call the question whether or not we should host the Republican National Convention next summer. And the council held, prior to their open meeting, I'm told, held a three-hour closed meeting with city attorney Patrick Baker about the city's contract. The council voted last year 6-5, was pretty split, to host the convention. Do we know how that vote would come down if it were held today?
Well, in talking to one of the council members, I was told if it were to happen today, he thinks that the vote would be 7-3.
For or against?
Against.
Against.
Not to hold it.
And we were the only city bidding for this. I don't think anybody
else
was in the
room. For the most part, I know Las Vegas was somewhat interested.
It was a private enterprise bidding for the
Correct.
Las Vegas convention,
Correct.
Not the city of.
Right. It didn't have the blessing of the city.
Right.
Right.
Councilmember LaWanna Mayfield, one of those who voted against bidding for the convention last time, said the council knew exactly what this man was, meaning Donald Trump. We knew exactly what his rhetoric was going to be. The time to do something was last year. And on that, she found agreement with the city attorney, who basically tossed a bucket of cold water on council's heated desires to rescind our bid to host that convention.
I think you should expect that you would be sued. For starters, and that there would be a request for injunctive relief to enjoin you from continuing the breach and to actually force the city of Charlotte to specifically perform under the contract. That is, I don't believe that you're going to be able to walk away from this contract, even if you were willing to pay the financial penalties for walking away. I don't believe that you'd be allowed to walk away.
Ed Driggs points out that the benefits the city will derive from hosting this convention this next summer have not changed since they made the bid. Okay, that's probably true. Have the negatives changed?
I think that's what people are worried about when you look at the Greenville rally. And will that be on?
But the Greenville rally was peaceful.
It was peaceful. But I think people are worried about what would happen in Charlotte over the period of a convention.
Mm-hmm. And a rally is one day, it's several hours, it's
invited
contained.
Guests.
Right. And a convention is not that. It's going to last longer than just a scheduled event.
You know, and there are some on the council and even some who spoke to the council Monday who expressed concern about whether we will have groups, white nationalist groups like the KKK and others, marching through the streets of Charlotte.
And not just them, but left-leaning groups as well, Antifa. There will be people coming in from all sides, no doubt, to try to score political points and to get on television, frankly. I hope I'm wrong. I hope it's peaceful. And it may very well be. But if it's not, it could leave an indelible stain on our city.
So, Joe, Channel 9 took a look at what's at stake if we were to pull out. We're not going to pull out, but if we were to, there's a lot at stake. What's at stake?
Oh, lots at stake. I mean, well, first of all, the city would be sued. And it's not just by the RNC. I mean, look at all the small businesses that are being awarded contracts. They could go after the city as well. The city would also have a lot of damage to its reputation as being known as a city that could pull back at any time. So if you're looking at major conventions, major events, are they going to trust that the city of Charlotte is a reliable partner to hold events? In terms of conventions, there really hasn't ever been a city that's rescinded an invite to a convention. We talked to a professor at UNC Charlotte who said, I guess there could be like a virtual convention to nominate Donald Trump as a Republican nominee, but that has never happened before. It just does not seem possible for the city of Charlotte to get out of this at this point. People could have had their made their voices heard. The lawmakers had their choice to make last year, and now they have to live with it.
Meanwhile, students, both the school and students at the school where Trump held that rally, Eastern Carolina University, have made some comments toward condemning what took place in that rally with the Send Her Back chants. The former student body president there, now an alumnus, drafted a letter on behalf of other alumni saying, Send Her Back is not inclusive, Send Her Back is not American, Send Her Back is not East Carolina University. Were there other alumni involved in writing that letter, and what has been the response to that and or the university's condemnation of what happened?
I haven't noticed much of any response from the White House, not only to that, but to Charlotte's resolution. So I haven't, if people are upset about these resolutions and the condemnations of these words, then they're not being very vocal about it.
So there were other things that City Council involved themselves on Monday with, as opposed to just this resolution. They voted unanimously in favor of funding 8 affordable housing projects at the cost of $12.8 million from the Housing Trust Fund, and they donated nearly $5 million in city-owned land to that purpose. This will feature a combination of new and rehabilitated units. Are most of them new? Most of these units that they're...
Most of the units are new, yes.
And how long will it take for them to come online?
It's going to be a couple of years, yes.
City Council also postponed a vote to renew a cargo and catering facility. This gets into the weeds.
It does.
They voted they postponed a vote to renew a cargo and catering facility lease with American Airlines at Charlotte Douglas International Airport. Why?
Council members Braxton Winston and Dimple Ejmyr had concerns about the employees impacted by this not receiving a livable wage. And
they're making something like $8 an hour, something like that?
It's single digits for most of them. But
and these are who?
These are
restaurant workers.
Restaurant workers, the people who bring the food to the airplanes.
Okay.
But really, City of Charlotte doesn't have any say over what American Airlines pays their employees. So that's why some council members...
And are these employees of American Airlines or are these subcontractors?
They're subcontractors. Yeah, we're really getting in the weeds. But,
yeah, I know.
Yeah, but so what they're hoping to do is kind of just send a message here that they want to bring American Airlines to the table so they can kind of talk about the importance of paying workers a living wage. But Councilmember Ed Driggs really cautioned the city from doing this too much, because one thing, you don't want to anger American Airlines and have them be up, have your major airline carrier at the airport be upset with you, but also just because the city of Charlotte really has no say in these matters.
Well, not only that, I don't understand. I know we own the airport, but the airport runs as an autonomous entity. The monies derived from the landing fees that American and other airlines pay to land at the airport stay with the airport. They don't come into the city coffers and vice versa. So why is the city even talking about what goes on at the airport?
They still have to approve contracts. Right. But what's interesting is this would actually...
Why? If it's a separate entity and money doesn't change hands between the city and the airport and they have their own director, why is the city involved at all?
Well, you might remember a few years back, the General Assembly tried to end that.
Yes. Is that what that was about? I thought they just wanted it for themselves. Okay. The Police Citizens Advisory Board met with CMPD Chief Kerr Putney to talk about the department's policy surrounding the use of deadly force. And The Observer has reported this week that members of the board were surprised by the chief's willingness to listen to their ideas, given the fact that the chief ask them to work on these new policy guidelines. Why would they be surprised that he would listen to the guidelines that they came up with?
Well, I think that's kind of interesting. Jane Wester had a really good article kind of breaking down some of the proposed changes. But, I mean, it's interesting that they say that they're surprised that he would listen. But, I mean, I think there's a difference between the chief will listen to what you're saying and the chief is going to then take some of those changes, which has yet to be seen if he's actually going to do that. Some of those changes, I think, are really interesting around the use of deadly force and around investigations. I mean, right now, if there's a shooting involving an officer, there are two investigations. There's the internal investigation from CMPD, and then there's the criminal investigation or review with the DA's office. And one of the proposed changes is that an independent investigation with the SBI or another entity would be implemented, which is something that doesn't happen right now unless the family involved, the victim's family, actually requests that. So that's a really interesting change, as well as the time frame of interviewing an officer who is involved in that. It has to be, they're saying it should be within 24 hours of the shooting or as soon as they get off their shift. So there are some really interesting changes, as well as discussing really specifics in the weeds about de-escalation and offering some more guidelines as to hoping that the police will use de-escalation tactics when they encounter someone.
And one other thing to add to that is the first aid policy, making sure that officers are increasing the level of providing medical aid. And it really reminds me of the moments after Dan Quirks Franklin was shot and killed outside of the Burger King. A lot of what these recommendations mirror what the chief said after watching the body cam video.
So let's go back through some of these. They suggested a change that would require the department to request an independent investigation of all uses of deadly force. What entity would be independent? Would it be the Police Review Board or some other entity they would bring in from elsewhere, like the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigation?
Yes.
That's who it would be.
Yes.
Is Putney on board with that?
Well, according to the Observer, he's interested in hearing and kind of thinking about that. I don't think he's come out and said that he wouldn't. Right. Wouldn't be opposed to that strongly at this point.
I just think he's open to hearing their suggestions.
They also emphasized de-escalation. When police arrive on the scene where a shooter or a potential shooter or a person with a weapon is involved, they want them to do what? To de-escalate the situation.
One thing that they outlined was making sure that officers are finding areas where they can be physically covered. So if that's opening a car door, so then they can have protection for the officer, but then also be able to have a conversation with that person so that maybe the officer feels more safe, that there's a barrier between somebody who may be armed and themselves. So that was one thing. And also having context when they get to the scene. And I think that's something, when we look at the Dan Quirks Franklin case, that was a big criticism of the police officers that responded, of just everything happened so quickly and there was so confusion about what was going on.
And intervening.
Yes.
Fellow officers, when they see another officer about to use deadly force, should they intervene and try to with that officer before they use that deadly force.
So I think this recommends other officers talking down the officer that may, it may appear that he's ready to fire. He or she is ready to fire.
Within
reason.
How do you determine the context? Good question. In the heat of the moment.
One of the things also proposed is that, quote, an armed person shall not automatically be deemed an immediate threat simply by virtue of being armed. And that seems to be difficult to determine, too.
Again, I think that the Citizens Review Board has put forward some policies that may not align with officer training, like align, you know, right up. But just hearing the chief again say that he's opening to hearing these things, and going back to what happened after the Dan Quirius Franklin officer-involved shooting, that he's at least going to consider some of the things that they put forward.
I think what they were recommending was just to slow the confrontation down, slow down the confrontation, set up a perimeter, don't go rushing in, guns blazing, but rather pull back a little, learn the context, use some de-escalation tactics, and use deadly force as a last resort. I, too, was a little surprised that Chief Putney appeared to be as receptive as he was in some of his statements, because he's been pretty clear that de-escalation starts with the suspect. De-escalation means put down the gun first. And until you put down the gun, there can be no de-escalation. So until I too was a little bit surprised that he was as receptive as he seemed.
As of Wednesday, Charlotte's homicide count, I believe, stands at 65. There were 58 in all of last year. And meanwhile, they've released the 911 call involving the shooting at the Steak and Shake on South Boulevard back on July 9th. What did we learn very quickly from those tapes, if anything?
Just a lot that, well, one thing that stuck out, the one employee that they included, there were five calls that were released there. It was one employee that was actually inside the business. He said that the suspect, Eddie Doe, came in shooting.
Wow. Okay, when we come back, more conversation about the proposed tax for the arts, sales tax for the arts, new superintendent at CMS. And a young man who was involved in a shooting at Butler High has pled guilty. We'll talk about that when we come back.
I'm Mike Collins. WFAE Charlotte Talks is hosting a public conversation to explore what can be done about the city's rising number of homicides. Only halfway through the year, Charlotte has already surpassed 2018's total. CMPD says this problem can't be law enforcement's alone to address, and they need your help. We examine the factors behind our homicide problem and what community leaders are doing to find solutions. Join us Tuesday, July 30th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church at 7:30 for this important conversation. More at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Glenn Berkins is here, publisher-editor of QCityMetro.com. Jonathan Lowe, anchor-reporter for Spectrum News. Joe Bruno is here from WSSC-TV Eyewitness News. And Sarah D'Elia, reporter for WFAE News. I stand corrected. I took a little pause. As I said, our homicide rate stands at 65 because I wasn't sure. And Joe Bruno pointed out during the break that it stands now at 66. That's as of Friday at 9:42 a.m. The county commission may okay a referendum this November to raise the sales tax, ostensibly to support the arts, parks, and greenways. I say ostensibly because once that passes, they can use the money for anything. They don't earmark it necessarily for that. But concerns about messaging for this quarter-cent sales tax has come from an unusual source. Tom Gabbard, president of Blumenthal Performing Arts. Evidently, when this idea first came to light in February, it was being positioned by some in the arts community as a way to alleviate a, quote, dire situation resulting from the collapse of their funding model, in which they went to employees at various companies and asked them to use payroll deduction. Gabbard has said to describe this as the imminent collapse of the cultural sector is total BS.
And particularly the message of a crisis in the cultural sector is something that that we thought was not the right choice at that time, and certainly is not the right choice now.
And he says the Arts and Science Council is concerned about their own diminished influence of in the face of declining contributions. Now, Tom Gabbard supports this tax, but he says voters in Denver, Colorado, when he worked there, and they were faced with a similar decision, did not support the tax there because of the, quote, whiny negative reasons that the ASC is articulating here now. Any reaction on these comments from the Arts and Science Council or the County Commission?
And you know what's interesting, Mike, because I went to one of the first presentations that the Arts and Science Council did for the county commissioners on this proposed sales since this tax and how they are in dire needs and dire straits. And they showed the county commissioners a presentation, and guess the ad that they showed the county commissioners?
I will imagine it's Denver.
You would be correct.
So the ASC, essentially, they are the closest thing to Charlotte has to a nonprofit arts organization. That's what they say. And the head of the ASC pointed out that somebody at the top ranks, at top echelons of the ASC pointed out that Blumenthal brings hits to town like Hamilton. Therefore, they aren't nonprofit, but they are nonprofit. In other words, they bring moneymakers, and the Arts and Science Council supports bare bones theater. On the other hand, County Manager Dina DiIorio points out that although the ASC is nonprofit, it is not a public organization. And that is why she has suggested that it be reconfigured to ensure more transparency about how they spend the money they get through this tax. Is that discussion just beginning? Is that still alive, that part of the discussion?
It is. You know? They still haven't decided that yet, but okay. They need to make a decision soon.
All right. So there are just a few days left in July. This is the month that we're supposed to get the good or the bad news with regard to property tax valuations. We're supposed to get our tax bills by the end of this month. What is today? The 26th of July. So I haven't gotten mine yet. Have you?
Clearly.
What's interesting is, though, if you are appealing the new value of your home, you will not get your new tax bill until that appeal is resolved. So David Tepper isn't getting a tax bill for Bank of America Stadium just yet because he is still appealing the value of that stadium.
Maybe I better check my stack of unopened mail. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board pulled the trigger last Friday, and they accepted the resignation of Clayton Wilcox as superintendent of schools. It was a move the board forced, and none of them will share their reasons for what they did, citing the law. When school board vice chair Elise Dashew was on this program on Monday, she alleged that those in the media who say that state law does allow the release of this kind of information to the public in some circumstances, she said that those who insist that this is true are misreading the law. So you guys are all in the media. Have any of our lawyers taken a look at this? Guess not.
Not mine, no.
Not mine.
What, you have no muckrakers here? What is wrong with you people? Acting Superintendent Ernest Winston was also on this program on Monday. He says he is focused on the future. It seemed to be a recurring theme from him and Elise Dashew, and getting schools ready to open next month.
Schools start in exactly 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. We are continuing to forge ahead. There will be, has not been, an interruption in the services that we provide. Our teachers, our principals, our building services staff are working hard every day to make sure that schools are prepared. That has not stopped. I think, contrary to popular opinion, if you will, CMS is still open for business. We are a stable school district.
Is that last comment even viable, given the fact that he is the sixth superintendent in 10 years?
He hit his talking points, but no, I think that, what other organization would this be acceptable, that we would accept this little transparency about knowing why the top figure was ousted from his position? So, I don't think you can say that CMS is stable. They've had six leaders since 2012, and I think that parents and teachers, when they hear those comments, they're thinking the same thing I am. That it's just not true.
Well, and let's look at one of the things that came out of this was the district admitting that they did not fingerprint, I think the number was over 3,000 employees, and they're still trying to fingerprint those people. And it We've got four weeks left, and they're still working to do that before school starts.
And some people have said that is what led to this dismissal or this...
One of the reasons.
If that's it, why don't they just say it? That seems defensible. Isn't it better to say something that's true and that is defensible than to say absolutely nothing and look like an idiot?
Absolutely.
Because that's what they look like.
Absolutely, it's true. The only other reason that we've heard trickle out from a source is there was some anger that Butler High School had to attend an extra day of school because the superintendent miscalculated the number of days by giving everybody off for the teacher rally in Raleigh. So Butler ended up having to make up the day they had off for the school shooting. That is between that and the fingerprints, those are the only reasons that we have heard displeasures for Clinton Wilcox's administration.
Often when there's a settlement or some type of financial arrangement, both sides agree kind of not to disparage the other side and not reveal certain things. So I'm speculating, but
He's not the president of the Bank of America. He's the head of a taxpayer-funded organization that voters support with their tax dollars. They should operate under a different set of rules. Should the law be changed? Should we petition the legislature to change the law?
Potentially, if people want to know why the superintendent was ousted.
Six of the nine members of the school board were on the board that selected Clayton Wilcox in secret. He was not paraded around to replace Ann Clark when she retired, and she replaced Heath Morrison, who was dismissed for reasons still not revealed officially by the board. They gave a bogus explanation that was disproved later on by the media. What does this tell us about this school board, or how this school board in the past vets candidates? And what about the politics of the school board and about the school board's ability to make sound decisions?
I think that there are some, you listen to parents now, some of the interviews that we've been getting, it definitely sounds like there's a transparency issue with the school board. And being as open as they possibly can without breaking the law on, as you just mentioned, a very crucial and important figurehead and leader, not really a figurehead, but an important leader here that affects hundreds of thousands of lives.
It's the most important organization in the city, isn't it?
Absolutely.
If people are unhappy with the CMS school board, they can have their say on November 5th and elect officials that are promising to be transparent.
Because Clayton Wilcox got a two-year contract extension and a raise 7 months ago by the same board that forced him out. Are we likely to learn any more going forward about this resignation? Is it possible for you guys to dig this up, or are we just going to have to settle for ignorance?
There are outstanding records requests, so you don't know what can turn up in those, and I do think that the media will not drop this issue.
Yeah, we definitely have asked for emails among the board.
On the good side of the ledger, Ernest Winston, the acting superintendent, who has been with the district now for 15 years, says he'll stay on track with the plans already in place for student assignment, the curriculum, and equity. And he says that all the buses will have drivers, and there are only 30 teacher vacancies. Now, last year, that was not the case. We had a lot of unmanned buses or unwomaned buses, and we had a lot of teacher vacancies. Did we not have as many vacancies this year because salaries are higher?
That's a good question. I mean, I know the figures. There were 78 teacher vacancies compared to 30 this year, and there were 44 bus driver openings last year. I mean, that's a great question as far as why we don't have that problem. Hopefully, that means it's a good thing. Hopefully, that means that things have turned around for teachers in Charlotte.
It's a good problem not to have.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Jatwan Cuffey, the student accused of killing a fellow classmate, Bobby McKeithen, in a Butler High School hallway last October, pleaded guilty this week to voluntary manslaughter. In fact, he did it yesterday. He turned 17 just last week, and he was sentenced to 80 to 108 months in prison. He could serve a maximum of nine years, probably more like six, one, I think somebody around this table said.
Yes.
What else do we know?
It was an emotional day in court. Both the families were there. Both the families spoke, and I say both. Bobby McKeithen, the victim, and Jatwan Cuffey's parents spoke after the hearing. Jatwan Cuffey's supporters, I guess I would paraphrase in some of those comments saying that, you know, this that with this sentence, that he will at least have the opportunity to have a life once he gets out of jail.
Where will he serve?
He will serve at the Mecklenburg County Jail, and that's because he is a juvenile. Mm-hmm. He will serve that entire sentence, is what we are told, in jail. He will not go to prison. Bobby McKeithen's family, his father, Bobby McKeithen Sr., was very poignant in saying that he feels like the system failed both families, that this has affected both teens and both of their lives essentially have been dramatically impacted. And he also said that, you know, this sentence really doesn't bring his son back. They could have, in his words, given Jatwan Cuffee the electric chair, and that still doesn't bring his family back. So it was really tragic, but being able to see how this has impacted those two families was very telling.
Glenn.
I think it was Cuffee's attorney who said that while he's in jail, he's going to focus on his future. And he indicated that Cuffee wants to start his own business at some point. But he emphasized that he's going to use this time away in a constructive way.
When things like this happen, this is a tragedy, I think, of epic proportions, particularly for the families involved. But Assistant District Attorney Desmond McCallum said that Cuffee did not claim to be a victim of bullying or harassment prior to the incident. He was just trying to hurt but not to kill Bobby McKeithen last October 29th. Is this a message that can get through to the community that seems to resort to gun violence at the drop of a hat? Do they see this as a personal tragedy on both sides of this equation? Do they see that this has ruined this young man's life and taken the life of another young man? It's going to be very difficult for Jatwan Cuffee to build a life after he gets out of this. He's a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
So do they see this? Is this a message getting through? Or is this just going to be another day in the life?
Unfortunately, I feel like the one comment that stuck out to me, Mike, in answering your question is the young individual that said, you know, he gets to have a life after this. Yeah. Essentially looking at 6 years is not very much time. And you think deeper about that and you're wondering, are teens looking at this, you know, high school students looking at this as, oh, I can bring a, in the words of the attorney that spoke, I can bring a gun to a fight and only get 6 years and have a life afterwards. Mm. I hope that that's not the reaction, but it certainly sounded like it in listening to some of the interviews yesterday.
So BB&T and SunTrust have come up against a roadblock in Maxine Waters, who serves in Congress on, I guess, the Banking Committee. She says this merger, the $66 million merger, which will result in a $440 billion bank in assets, creates a bank that's too big to fail. She says this is not a good idea. Is this going to stop it? Does anybody know?
I don't think it's going to stop it at this point, but this is part of the process that it has to go through before it's all signed off on.
Okay. Big day came and went earlier this week. The Robert Mueller testimony, some have described as a big nothing burger, left people on both sides of the aisle holding the same opinions they had prior to his testimony. No members of the House on either grilling team were from North Carolina, but here's what North Carolina Republican and chair of the House Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows, had to say when he called it the hearings a flop.
Yeah, hopefully this puts an end to it. I don't think it's going to create the narrative that many of my Democrat colleagues were hoping for. At the same time, they've drawn their conclusions. Most of America has already drawn their conclusion, and that's that the president shouldn't be impeached. This is just really a prelude to that.
And as you would expect, North Carolina Democratic Congressman G.K. Butterfield tweeted that it's clear the Mueller report does not exonerate the president, and he told Spectrum News it's time to begin an impeachment inquiry.
I want to begin the inquiry. I'm not ready to vote affirmatively for impeachment, but I want to get all of the facts on the table, and getting the Mueller report into the hands of Congress and getting it on the minds of the American people is a good beginning.
And we'll leave it at that. Glenn Birkins, Jonathan Lowe, Joe Bruno, Sarah D'Elia, thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.